Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from Commissioners Catalina v. Clydesdale.
May it please the Court, Mr. Mitchell, I'd like to introduce argument from Petitioners. Petitioner, with regard to 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Mitchell Buckman. I represent Petitioners James and Cheryl Catalina. This proceeding originated, response as plaintiffs in the trial court, originated with a usury claim. The trial was to the court, and the court was the County Court of Law Number 3 in Harrison County. The basis of the cause of action is a contract that was entered into between the parties, denoted a floor plan agreement, whereby my clients provided financing for the acquisition of vehicles, which were then in turn sold by the respondent at the respondent's used car lot. The claim arising from that contract was that the sums of money that were paid to my client, in addition to the repayment of principal obligations, constituted interest, and that the interest paid was in excess of the maximum amount permitted by law. Now, interest is defined by the statute and also under common law is defined as the compensation received for the use, forbearance, or detention of money. Courts have defined the use of money being that which is contracted for when a loan was made. Courts have defined forbearance to be that which is contracted for when there is an extension agreement on an existing obligation when that debt becomes due. Detention of money arises in a situation where a debt becomes due and there is no agreement to extend the date of payment and the sums are not paid. In this instance, the claim was for compensation for the use of the money pursuant to the terms of the floor plan agreement. So this is a case, what I term in my brief, as a use case, a use of money case. The trial court found in favor of the petitioner and entered a take-nothing judgment. The court entered findings of fact and conclusions of law. Those findings and conclusions found that the contract itself was not usurious and did not represent a usurious transaction. The court found the agreement was unambiguous. The court found that there was no absolute obligation to repay principal pursuant to the terms of the agreement, and that as such, the contract did not represent a usurious transaction. The case was appealed. The appellate court reversed and rendered judgment in favor of the respondent in this proceeding. The Court of Appeals reversed the decision on the grounds that the absolute obligation to repay principal, which in the appellate court as appellee, I was arguing the authority of Holly versus Watt, did not apply in a situation where the usurious interest had been charged or received. And in this instance, as the evidence indicated in the lower court, sums had been received by my clients in excess of the amount that would have been considered the maximum permissible rate. It is the petitioner's contention here before this court that the appellate court was an error in its decision. As stated in my brief, it is our position that the appellate court has literally put the cart before the horse. The appellate court's rationale in disregarding Holly v. Watt essentially relies upon the Windhorse case, which construed Section 5069-106, which is the penalty provision of the usury statute. The court stated that that statute, which provides for interest penalties, penalties for usury in the event that the there is a contracting for charging or receiving of usurious interest, the court held that since that language is read in the disjunctive, that just receiving usurious interest was sufficient to support a cause of action, and the three elements enunciated in Holly versus Watts did not apply. Our argument essentially is that the section relied upon, 5069-106, is not the section of the statute that creates the cause of action or that even sets forth the elements of the cause of action. The statute itself set in the body of the statute states that any person who contracts for charges or receives interest which is greater than the amount authorized by the subtitle, and then refers to 5069-101, which sets forth the various definitions of what constitutes interest, what constitutes usury. It is our contention, therefore, that reviewing and relying upon 5069-106 as the basis for determining that we do not need an absolute obligation to repay principal to constitute a usurious transaction misses the mark because it's reviewing the wrong section of the usury statute. The proper consideration here, the proper determination, has to be based upon 5069-101 and the case law that has always interpreted what usury consists of, what interest consists of.
Do you contend this was an investment?
No, Your Honor. We did not argue that this was some form of sham transaction. The argument that we've made consistently has been that there is no absolute obligation to repay principal as contained in the agreement testified to by the parties and was found by the trial court, and which was not contested in the some of those findings which were not contested in the appellate court below.
Is this just a proof oversight? The document just missed it, or is it typical in floor planning arrangements that the person who provides the financing floor planning just never makes arrangements to get paid back?
No, Your Honor. The evidence, which is very clear at trial, is that the parties did not consider a situation whereby what would happen if a vehicle was not sold. The contract basically provided that the payments were to be made as the vehicles were sold. There was no provision in the contract that said, in the event a vehicle is not sold, the respondent in this case still has to pay the principal amount by a certain date or over a certain period of time. The contract was silent. In fact, the contract only states that the payments only occur upon the sale of the vehicle. This is, I can't testify, nor were there testimony that this was a standard form contract in the industry. In fact, the testimony was that my client basically just drew it up by hand, and so there's no evidence of this being a standard form of any kind.
If all the vehicles had been sold and all the money had been paid, would Blaisdell have a cause of action for usury?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Under these circumstances, the cases cited by Holly, namely Pansy Oil, which is cited in my brief, and all of the other cases that Pansy Oil relies upon, all set forth the proposition that in an agreement of this nature, where the obligation to repay principal is contingent and is not absolute, the underpinnings of the transaction cannot form the basis of a usurious transaction. And therefore, even upon receipt of usurious sums, by the way, Your Honor, in Holly versus Watts, the allegedly usurious interest had been received. In Pansy versus Oil, approximately $24,000 had been received on a $10,000 loan over a relatively short period of time. Receipt of the interest has never been the focal point of the cases dating back to the early part of the century. It has always been, the focal point has always been the underlying transaction. And the focal point has been three elements. Number one, that a loan of money occurs. Number two, that an absolute obligation to repay principal must be part of the transaction. And number three, that there is an exaction of interest in excess of the amount allowed by law. It's that focal point on those three elements that Holly versus Watts reaffirmed in its opinion, and which is the basic rule of law cited by case law in the last 100 years in this jurisdiction.
Well, let's accept the floor planning arrangement that the Catalinas had with Blaisdell. What is the significance to an absolute as opposed to a contingent obligation to repay that is why you have usury in one instance and you don't have usury in another instance even though you're paying a whole bunch of interest?
Reading the older cases that construe this area of the law as it developed, the whole concept of usury in Texas and as it developed, usury at its inception focused on loans of money. Obviously now you can have usury in credit transactions or sales transactions, but it focused, in my opinion, on a loan of money. I think it defeats the very purpose of the concept of a loan if there's not an obligation to repay the money. And I think maybe that's the heart of the origination of this concept, that if the loan does not contain an absolute obligation to repay pay principal, there maybe wasn't a loan to base the usurious or the allegations of usurious interest. I think this also somewhat fits into the public policy considerations that the legislatures were considering and the public policy considerations today. The preamble of the statute says that the purpose is to protect consumers from unscrupulous lenders. my clients, I would argue, are not unscrupulous lenders, but I put this proposition to the court. If that's the public policy, then the enunciation by this court of the rule that where there is not an absolute obligation to restate principles, there cannot be a usurious transaction, is actually consistent with that policy, because this is a double-edged sword. If there isn't an absolute obligation to repay principal, there's not an enforceable claim against the consumer. So it is a situation here where if the court follows the case law that has been in place for in the state of Texas, you're actually following the public policy considerations and supporting the public policy considerations, because no lender in his right mind is going to intentionally put a provision in the agreement that renders his ability or her ability to pursue that principal obligation and to collect that principal obligation moot.
Right. What was your client's remedy if Catalina did not choose to return unsold cars? You just let them have them?
Under the terms of the agreement, my client had no remedy. In fact, the record shows pursued no claim against Mr. Blasdale. What Mr. Blasdale did
was repossess some of the vehicles.
The cars were turned over by Mr. Blasdale at his decision. My client did not go and repossess the vehicles. And there's no...
And you're saying he wouldn't have. If Blasdale just wanted to keep the cars, that would have been fine.
There was no evidence of what my client would or wouldn't have done at that point, because Mr. Blasdale initiated the call that terminated the transaction that told him to come and pick up the vehicles. As a practical matter, he did have possession of the car titles, and the vehicles couldn't have been sold without his release of those car titles. But there was not a security arrangement in there for repossession. There was no security agreement, no testimony regarding any type of rights of that nature, either in the testimony of the parties or in the contract itself.
What were the provisions of the floor plan beyond the 90-day period that the car was not sold?
There were no provisions.
Were no provisions? Did continue to pay the monthly fee?
No, Your Honor. Past a certain point, the contract provided for reduction of half of the principal outstanding, but then beyond that point, there was no provisions for any principal reduction or any continued charge.
Paid, what was it, 3% and 10% or 60-something dollars?
There were what they termed floor plan fees.
Floor plan fees, which amounted to a certain amount if the amount advanced was $500 or less, and 10% per vehicle if it was more than $500. And after a period of, what was it, 90 days, the payment of 50% of the principal amount. And then it stopped.
And it stopped.
What happens to these cars after 90 days? Do they just evaporate into the ether? Or?
Under the agreement, the cars remained under the agreement, remained with on the floor plan with the respondent. But what's the consequence from a usury standpoint is there was no obligation of the respondent to repay the remaining 50% until the car was sold. And that was what the agreement specifically said. And there was testimony from both sides that there was never any consideration beyond that point that he would have to make a continued principal reduction of any kind. There was no agreement on those issues. The car had to be sold before the remaining portions of the principal were retired.
For advancing this money, Blasdale's got what was allowable to them under the 90-day provision, and then the Catalinas could keep the vehicles indefinitely and never pay another penny on the financing of these vehicles.
I think this contract cuts both ways, Your Honor. I think under the terms of this agreement, beyond the 90-day period,
so
there was no agreement.
If they didn't sell cars for 5 years,
then it turned into a bad business deal, Your Honor. I mean, essentially, it would have been a bad business deal on my client's part, but they didn't provide for anything, and there was no testimony of any implied agreement on these issues. There was no agreement on that.
Well, even if you conceded that under the short-term situation, this would be a usurious amount if it was construed in interest to be paid on the principal advance, you have to be arguing that in the indefinite long term, there's no one can say.
And actually, Your Honor, I don't concede even at the
well, even as said, I think I hope I qualify. Even if you did concede that, you would have to argue that since it was open-ended at the other end and they never were obligated to pay another penny, no one could say over the long term whether these amounts the amount paid upfront on the amounts advanced was usurious over a long-term period.
Theoretically, yes, Your Honor.
It's an indefinite period.
Theoretically, yes, Your Honor. And in fact, the trial court specifically found that the payment of principal was contingent upon the sales of those vehicles and found the agreement was not ambiguous on that point. And they, those issues were not contested upon the appeal. Those findings. Getting back to the issues, we believe that the case law does support our contentions. We believe that the lower court's basic failure to follow Holly versus Watts was not proper. In fact, in a subsequent decision by this Supreme Court, Lawler versus Lomas and Dettles, the mortgage corporation, this court cited Holly versus Watts' authority. I don't think the lower court's decision to just disregard Holly versus Watts was proper at all just because it was a venue case. But this court itself has followed it. I think those three elements exist. They're still the underpinnings of the basic usury claim, and I don't believe that the language in the penalty provisions of the statute, 5069-106, have modified the nature or basis of the cause of action. They've only set forth the penalties that are in place in the event a cause of action accrues.
Any questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Marcus Fabian will present argument for respondent.
If it pleases the court, I'm Marcus Fabian. I represent the respondent, Bill Blaisdell, in this case.
Gentlemen, what does happen to these cars after 90 days?
The contract didn't say, Your Honor. And I asked both Blaisdell and Catalina at trial, why didn't you provide for the what happens after 60 days? It's actually 60 days, Judge. And both of them said, we just never thought that any car would remain unsold for longer than 60 days. In this case, that happened. None of the cars remained unsold for longer than 60 days. At the time Blaisdell decided to terminate the arrangement, there was no provision in the contract for termination either. What they did was make an agreement as to how the contract and the relationship was to be terminated at that time. And Catalina agreed to come over and take those five cars off Blaisdell's lot and break off the relationship. But I asked Mr. Catalina at trial, and I've cited this portion of the statement of facts in my brief to the Court of Appeals, which is before this court also. I asked him, I said, did Blaisdell owe you for those five cars? And he said, he sure did. And those were his very words that he testified to. For counsel to make an argument that the contract contains no absolute obligation to repay principal addresses only one of the three contingencies that trigger the usury penalties.
You do agree with that? You do agree that it does not contain an absolute agreement?
No, I do not, Your Honor. I do not concede that point. Points of Error 1 and 2 before the Court of Appeals argued that the contract did, in fact, contain an absolute obligation to repay principal, and there are four provisions in this contract that provide for repayment of principal, paragraphs 7, 9, 10, and 14, and they address the only thing that is not addressed.
Counsel says that your client testified that there was no such agreement. Is that an error?
That there's no such obligation to repay the principal?
Yes.
That is an error, yes.
Did you contest any of the findings of fact made by the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor, we did. We contested the finding that the contract did not contain an absolute obligation to repay the principal. That was the subject of points of error 1 and 2 before the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals did not rule on those two points. The Court of Appeals ruled on point number three only. And the third point was that regardless of the contract, that Catalina still charged and received usurious interest. And for that reason, the penalty should be imposed. The Court of Appeals sustained that point and rendered judgment because at the trial court, there was no disagreement about what sums of money were paid and when or the amounts. In fact, Mr. Catalina's own handwritten records were introduced as evidence. Mr. Blaisdell's canceled checks were introduced as evidence, and they matched, and there was no disagreement. So the evidence before the Court of Appeals was fair, whereby they could render the judgment in this case, and that's what they did. But the argument that counsel makes here that this is not a usurious
transaction. Before we move on to the other points, where in the contracts do we have an absolute obligation to repay the principal? Where is that found?
Okay, paragraph 7.
You have paragraph 7 there? What does it read?
This is the provision for half the principal after 60 days. No automobile will be floored for more than 60 days. If occasion arises, the automobile must be reduced 50%, and a third floor fee will be incurred at the agreed rate of a minimum of $60 or 10% of the new floored amount. Paragraphs 9.
You're saying that provision that you just read is an absolute obligation to repay the principal?
One half of the principal on any car remaining on the floor for longer than 60 days, yes.
Well, how about the other half?
The contract is silent about that, Your Honor.
Well, how can it be, if it's silent on half of the principal, how can you have how can you make a statement that you have an absolute obligation to repay the principal if that provision you just read only addresses half of the principal?
Okay, well, it is part of the principal. It is the contract is silent as to the other half.
Well, let me be clear about my question then. Do you contend that there was an absolute agreement to repay all the principal?
Yes, in certain circumstances. And let me explain that if I could. Paragraph 7 says if a vehicle remains on the floor for longer than 60 days, half of the principal is to be paid. Paragraph 9 says if an automobile is missing from the lot, all the principal is due and all the floor fees. Paragraph 10 says that when an automobile is sold, all of the principal and all the floor fees are payable in 24 hours. Paragraph 14 says if an automobile is stolen or vandalized, all the principal and all the floor fees are due and payable at once. And that addresses those four provisions.
But all those provisions are contingent on the sale of an automobile.
No, they're not. And the contract does not say that if an automobile is not sold, that Mr. Blaisdell does not owe for the automobiles. And in fact, in the case with the five automobiles that were not sold at the termination of the agreement, I asked Mr. Catalina, did he owe you for those? And he said he sure did. And so the part he understood the agreement, and he testified at trial that Mr. Blaisdell owed Mr. Catalina for those five unsold cars. If I may proceed to answer your question.
What were those three contingencies that trigger a usurious agreement that you were talking about? You want to run by?
Okay. The 5069-1.06 states that the penalties of usury are triggered when one contracts for or charges or receives usurious interest. The statute is written in the disjunctive, and there's quite a few cases that state, and this court has so ruled, that because the statute is written in the disjunctive, only one of the three conditions must occur for the penalties of usury to be triggered. The argument that counsel is making here addresses only one of the three, and that is contracting for. It does not address charging or receiving. And that's the point I made to the Court of Appeals. That and this is what was sustained by the Court of Appeals, that the charging and receiving acts on the part of Catalina triggered the usury penalties regardless of what was in the contract or not in the contract. And the analogy that I would like to draw is, had there been no written contract at all, but had this agreement, instead of being written down on paper by Mr. Catalina, who prepared this contract by himself without the assistance of an attorney, but had there been no contract and this transaction had taken place, then the penalties of usury would still be triggered because of the charging and receiving acts on the part of Mr. Catalina.
Let me ask you the same question I asked the counsel a while ago. Apparently this contract proceeds into infinity. Pays the floor plan fees, $60 or 10%, depending on the value of the vehicle, the amount advanced on the vehicle, on each one, the floor plan fee, and after a period of time, pays 50% repays 50% of the principal, regardless of how long the vehicle may be kept in the future. There's no provision for any future floor plan fees. There's no provision for any future repayment unless the vehicle is sold, vandalized, missing, stolen. Mm-hmm. 2 years go by. After this initial 60-day period, these initial three or four floor plan payments, and the repayment of the 50%. What happens? 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, what happens? The vehicle's still sitting there unsold, unvandalized, unstolen, and unmissing.
According to the contract is silent about that, Your Honor. According to Mr. Catalina, his testimony at trial, Mr. Blaisdell still owed him the principal on that vehicle. Had it been sitting on his lot for 2 years?
What about the repossession of the five vehicles?
Mr. Catalina testified at trial that Mr. Blaisdell still owed him for those five vehicles. I cited the passage in my brief that's before the court.
That would be a debt that no statute of limitations would ever run on, isn't
it? I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
That would be a debt that would never be barred by statute of limitations.
I'm sure while statute of limitations would come in there someplace, Your Honor.
While you're mulling that over, what about spreading these amounts paid over the entire potential period of the loan, which is infinity? They would not be usurious over a five-year period, probably, if that was the entire amount paid. Only if you consider the short term would they be usurious with it.
Well, that's, I guess it wouldn't be, but that's not what happened here, Your Honor. None of these cars were on the lot for longer than 60 days. The question never came up. It never even occurred to either Blaisdell or Catalina that any car would remain unsold for longer than 60 days, so they didn't make that provision in the contract. Both of them so testified at trial.
Wasn't there a 1978 Mercury Grand Marquis who was been on the lot for over 90 days?
No, Your Honor. I think that car was 1978 Mercury Marquis.
Yes.
The one I see, Your Honor, shows it was bought on October the 10th of 1989 and was paid for on December the 11th, 1989, which would be probably about 61 days, 62 days. And I believe Mr. Blaisdell paid 3 months, 3 floor plan fees for each 30 days that the vehicle was on the lot.
So you have three paid fees for three floor plans parked there for more than 90 days?
That's right.
How do you pay for three floor plans if these floor plans, I mean, provision is for 30 days?
The floor plan fee was payable each 30 days, according to the testimony at trial.
And for this car, he paid for three. So the car was there in the lot for longer than 90 days?
There slightly over 61, about slightly over 60 days. But it was paid for. There was no car that was not paid for on the lot for longer than 60 days.
How can you pay three floor plans for a car that is there less than 90 days?
Because there was a floor plan for each 30 days. The first 30 days was days 1 through 30. The second 30 days was days 31 through 60. And the third 30 days was day 61 on. And as soon as the next day, according to the way that they testified at trial, every 30 days rolled around, another floor fee became payable. So each 30 days, one triggered in. There is a line of cases I've cited in my brief also which stresses that in any inquiry to determine the existence or non-existence of usury, it's the form of the transaction, the substance of the transaction, which must be examined, and not simply the form of the transaction. And in examining this particular transaction as to whether or not there was an absolute obligation to repay principal, the facts substantiate that it was the intent that the 10% per month be charged here. And in fact, the facts substantiate that all of the principal and all of the interest that was due, Mr. Catalina, was in fact paid. The money has actually changed hands, but for the five vehicles that were returned to Catalina at the end of the business relationship. And I would stress to the court that the substance of this transaction is what's much more important than the form of the contract. If the contract stated, which it does not, but if it stated that if any car remains unsold that Blaisdell doesn't owe for it, then perhaps they would have a point. But the contract doesn't say that. Neither do their actions support that. What happened is that the principal was, and all the interest, was paid to Catalina.
Why would they have a point if it were expressly provided in the contract?
Because there would it would be, and it would, it might be a ground for them to argue that that would be vitiate the absolute obligation to repay the principal. But I say they might have a point. I'm not agreeing that they would, because what the whole purpose of the contract was for Catalina to lend his money for Blaisdell to buy vehicles for resale off of his lot. And in fact, paragraph 24 of the contract states that Catalina's only involvement is as a financier. He specifically excludes himself as being a partner or in business with Blaisdell. That brings me back to the point I just made, that the substance of the transaction is a loan of money and a repayment of the principal with interest.
Counsel, I think both Holly versus Watts and Lola versus Lomas and Nettleton Mortgage investors hold that an absolute obligation to repay the principal is an essential element of a claim for usury. Do we have to overrule these two cases and others to stand for the same proposition in order to hold for you?
No, Your Honor, but I believe that it would, and I would suggest to the court that the definition of usurious transaction in Holly versus Watts be limited to cases in which one has violated the statute by contracting or charging, but not as to receiving. Holly versus Watts is a plea of privilege case. It was not a usury case. It cited 1936 Texarkana Court of Appeals case, Pansy Oil versus Federal Oil. I wonder if that's really the best authority upon which to define usurious transaction. And I also question whether or not the statute, the usury statutes, don't stand on their own.
A Lawler was a 1985 case from this court. Same proposition.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what do we have to say about that case?
The point I was trying to make, Your Honor, is I wondered, do we need a definition of usurious transaction in light of the usury statutes themselves? The effect is of the definition in Holly versus Watts is to limit the applicability of the usury statutes. And in this case, kind of an escape mechanism by which petitioner is attempting to avoid the penalties of usury. The statutes themselves do not say that they apply only to situations where there is a loan of money. The statutes of themselves don't say that they apply only where there is an absolute obligation to repay principal. And in this case, there are other cases where those issues didn't even come up. For example, Tubelite versus Risica and Sons, decided by this court recently, was a usury case involving excessive charging of interest on an invoice sent by a seller to a purchaser of goods. And in practical terms, there was no loan of money there. No money changed hands. It was a sale of goods on credit.
But there was an absolute obligation to repay for those goods.
That issue did not come up in Tubelite versus Risica and Sons, Your Honor. Perhaps it should have, but to say that Holly versus Watts and that definition of usurious transaction applies to every usury case, and it seems to say that, as a practical matter, it doesn't. It can't, because not every credit transaction involves a loan of money. The credit transactions which this court has addressed have been sales of goods, and other types of credit transactions in which there's been excessive charging of interest by placing, as in Tube Light, 1.5% per month on the invoices. And I believe, practically speaking, the definition in Holly versus Watts cannot and should not apply to every usury case and should be limited to contracting and perhaps charging violations, but certainly not as to receiving violations, as in this case.
Does this have any similarity to if Mr. Blaisdell was acting as a broker and reselling?
No, Your Honor, there's nothing in the contract and there was no testimony at trial regarding whether Mr. Blaisdell was a broker. The way it worked was the titles were held by Mr. Catalina until the vehicles were sold and paid for, at which time the titles were returned to Mr. Blaisdell so he could pass the transfer title to the purchasers of the vehicles.
Well, so Mr. Catalina had cars that he was giving to Mr. Blaisdell to sell, and upon sale, remit.
No, Your Honor, Mr. Catalina was providing money for Mr. Blaisdell to purchase vehicles. Mr. Blaisdell would purchase a vehicle and pay for it by means of an envelope draft, which would be sent to Mr. Catalina's bank. Mr. Catalina would then go to the bank, examine the title, and if everything were in order, would pay the draft. In the meantime, Mr. Blaisdell would take the vehicle and put it on his lot for resale. In certain instances, Mr. Catalina went out and bought vehicles and held the titles. They were put on Mr. Blaisdell's lot and held for resale by Mr. Blaisdell. But there was no testimony about anybody being what they would determine among themselves to be brokers.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Please, the court. The respondent and petitioner disagree on some of the basic facts in the underlying case. We both cited our references to the record. I'd note that in the appellate court's decision on page 3, it says that the appellant did not challenge the trial court's finding that the written contract contained the complete agreement of the parties. The contract is what controls the situation. That's the agreement that we look at. Mr. Catalina's testimony of what he may have done, would have done, or could have done isn't what the court found and isn't what the appellate court in its decision said was the nexus that this court had to look at in order to determine the rights and remedies of the parties. The court asked what circumstances could you limit Holly versus Watts in order to avoid this requirement of the absolute obligation of repay principle. Prior to coming here today, I've racked my brain trying to think of examples where you might limit Holly versus Watts. What I think is important, though, is that this is a case involving the use of money. And as I started in my original presentation, there are three different ways of receiving interest: use, forbearance, and detention. Those three mechanisms involve different types of transactions. And while you might come up with a mechanism involving a detention case that doesn't involve a loan of money, the very nature or definition of the use of money includes the statement that it is what you contract for when the loan is made. It's what is contracted for. And this contract in this instance, or what is contracted for when the loan is made, can only be in a loan transaction. Now, while you may call it a sale transaction, a sale on credit in effect is a loan of the money to purchase the goods. You can still get to the basic nature of any agreement where you either loan money directly or advance credit as a form of a loan, as still being a loan transaction. I don't see an exception to Holly versus Watts in a use case per se, and I haven't seen any case law that carves out an exception. And in fact, in Pansy Oil and all of the cases prior to Pansy Oil, they predominantly deal with the use of money scenario where the court was construing in that situation what was being asked by the parties to the contract. It was a loan transaction, but there was a contingency where the obligation to repay principle was not absolute, and that, in every case I've read, destroys the ability to maintain a usury cause of action. And I haven't seen a change in the statute that would create a reason to change the law on that issue. In fact, the only real change I see in the statute in the definition section of what constitutes interest is, under the early common law cases, it was the use and forbearance, and the legislature, following the trend, has added the word detention to take into account those instances where you don't have any kind of an agreement and a charge of interest occurs, after for some other form or for some other reason. So there's been a change in the statute, but it in no way alters or amends what has been the traditional concepts that have applied in this instance to the requirement that there be an absolute obligation repayment principle. Thank you.
That concludes the arguments and the third call. The foregoing causes are all submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now adjourn.
Thank you.